KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I sat there and I thought, well, what would he want? And I knew he would have wanted me to finish the movie.
Bobcat Goldthwait became famous for his screaming stand-up comedy, but these days he's primarily a director. His documentary, Call Me Lucky, on the life and troubled times of one of his mentors, comedian and activist Barry Crimmins, was partly funded by Goldthwait's good friend Robin Williams. But on the last day of filming, Goldthwait learned that Williams had died. He tells us about that special friendship and how his career has evolved from his days in Police Academy. But first on the News Banter, a great summer at the box office, but only for two studios. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my banter buddy, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Kim.
So, summer box office, we can take a look back now, and we can say it was like the tale of two summers. If you were Universal or Disney, especially Universal, I think you and Joe Adalian talked about this last week when I was away, record-breaking year for Universal. If you were Disney or Universal, yay! If you're the rest, not so yay.
Not so much, yeah. Universal has now passed the $2.1 billion mark domestically, which is a new record, thanks to movies like Jurassic World, which was just a phenomenon. And of course, most recently, Straight Outta Compton, continuing to do well at the BO.
Yeah, they just have Minions and one thing after another. Ted 2, the only thing that really didn't work for them. And I think people are willing to let them have a pass on that one, given what Donna Langley has done. The one woman running a studio is on fire.
Absolutely.
And Disney, of course, has Age of Ultron, the Avengers movie, which was the number two movie this summer in terms of gross, and also has Pixar with number three, Inside Out, original. What a concept, Mike. An original film.
By the way, one of the few in the top 10, if you look down the list. I mean, it is mostly remakes, reboots, or, of course, extensions of familiar franchises.
Right. We had Straight Outta Compton and San Andreas in the top 10, but a lot of Mission Impossible 5 and this and that.
Right.
So, yeah, Disney also just chewing up the box office this summer.
Again, thanks to these franchises. Ant-Man, of course, at number six, another Marvel movie.
Now, interestingly, Marvel has the secret sauce. I mean, Ant-Man wasn't their biggest movie, but everything seems to work reasonably well. Fox with Fantastic Four took one of the biggest shots of the summer. That was just a debacle. You know, it's sort of there was a hint before it was released when Josh Trank, the very young, well, you know, 30-ish director of the film, was let go from a Star Wars standalone, and everybody kind of was like, what was that about? And he had some, you know, I'm going to follow my other dreams. But what it really was about was that they'd heard that there were huge problems on Fantastic Four. Fox just does not seem to be able to do it with the consistency of Marvel.
No, and as a matter of fact, you mentioned that he's young, Josh is, but at the same time, he should have known better than to actually air his grievances on Twitter. He quickly deleted that, but at that point, it had already spread throughout the universe, and he's kind of become persona non grata in Hollywood.
Yeah, he said that he had a version of the movie that was much better than the studio released, which, by all accounts, I've talked to a lot of people who worked on that film, and not really. I mean, it's hard to say whether it was as bad as the one or worse than the one, but either way, there was not enough. We've seen films get saved in the past. That, you know, Paramount redid the whole third act of World War Z and saved it. So it can be done, but you have to have some raw material to work with, and it seems that in the case of Fantastic Four, it simply wasn't there. And Trank, untested except for this movie Chronicle, which was a sort of a surprise hit, but very small, a little little movie. Colin Trevorrow is the director of Jurassic World, surrounded by a lot of strength. Steven Spielberg is the executive producer. Frank Marshall, who's directed films and produced the Bourne series and the Indiana Jones movies. I mean, a lot of experience there to back him up, but he executed well enough to have a great new job.
As a matter of fact, he's been hired as the director of the 9th Star Wars movie, so obviously a career on the rise.
Yeah, so Trank out, Trevorrow in, and some can get it done. Apparently, it's very tough to do these big movies, and I'm not suggesting that it's by any means easy.
No.
Meanwhile, Disney, as we just mentioned, devouring the box office for summer, they are gearing up a Star Wars onslaught. My colleague tweeted today that he feels like he's already seen the movie because this thing is so out there.
Yeah, yeah. But the fact is now that Disney's even making a big deal about a series of videos of people unboxing Star Wars merchandise. They're making an event out of this, Kim. 18 hours.
An epic global event.
And by the way, they know that there are fans who will sit down in front of YouTube and watch 18 hours of celebrities across the world unboxing Star Wars product.
Yeah. And they're also taking over IMAX theaters for a month. So anybody else who's in that space is going to be too bad for you. It's been done before, but not too often. Clearly they are just looking to cash in, and who can blame them? I mean, every studio in town would just die of envy to have something like that.
Oh, absolutely. And this is just the beginning. We forget this is just the first in the onslaught of Star Wars that we'll be experiencing over the next several years.
Okay, here's my segue, Mike. They're obviously looking to continue this multi-generational Star Wars phenomenon. And speaking of multi-generations, Netflix, which has roped in all of us people of a certain age.
Speak for yourself, Kim.
I will. With Orange is the New Black and House of Cards, they're going after the young.
A classic cradle-to-grave strategy. Obviously, Netflix has a deal with Disney that's coming out next year, so they're going to get a lot of the young folks, the kids, who are very important to this. They're getting the oldsters, not just with the shows you mentioned, but even the older demo. They acquired Longmire, which was a show that did well for A&E, not in the young demos, but for Netflix, that doesn't matter. They're getting the 55-plus crowd for that. The one segment of the population that they've sort of been lacking in has been tweens and teens, but they're trying to change that now at Netflix as well.
They're bringing back or repurposing Degrassi and Fuller House.
Yeah, Degrassi is a franchise that's actually been around for a while. It's a Canadian import that did well on PBS in the 80s and 90s and then moved to Teen Nick and has a whole new generation of fans. Teen Nick canceled it, so Netflix, like it's been doing with a lot of products, has jumped in and now is going to take over airing new episodes. And then, of course, Fuller House, which is the next evolution of Full House. Again, a show that was hot in the 90s, but a whole new generation of teens have watched Full House repeats on Nickelodeon and Nick at Night for years. They love it so much that it's coming back. And Netflix, again, acquired it.
For me, my teen is already watching a terrifying amount of Netflix, so I am not sure I'm happy about this. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. The documentary Call Me Lucky profiles Barry Crimmins, a stand-up comic with a taste for sharp political satire. In the 1980s, Crimmins ran a Boston comedy club where talent including Stephen Wright and Paula Poundstone also performed. Crimmins was known for angry comedy, and one day in 1992, a possible reason emerged. Crimmins revealed during a performance that he had been a victim of brutal sexual abuse as a child. He became a crusader who testified before Congress, taking on AOL over the proliferation of child pornography on the internet. Today, Crimmins lives in an isolated cabin in upstate New York. But as is clear in Call Me Lucky, he hasn't lost his activist zeal.
Well, there's a couple of things I have to accomplish, and if I do, I think I'll be able to put my little tile in the grand mosaic of life. And those two things are, I'd like to overthrow the government of the United States, and I'd like to close the Catholic Church.
The director of Call Me Lucky is Bobcat Goldthwait, a stand-up who got his start in clubs owned by Barry Crimmins. That's where Goldthwait worked out his distinctive sound. Now an established director, Goldthwait knows he's doomed to be remembered for his role as Zed in the Police Academy movies.
Attention! I need beer up here! Now!
Goldthwait still does comedy, but he also directed Jimmy Kimmel Live for 3 years, and his credits include many episodes of Marc Maron's IFC show, Maron. Call Me Lucky is his third film to go to Sundance. But it all began with Barry Crimmins.
I met Barry when I was 16. There was an ad looking for stand-up comedians in our local paper, alternative paper, and Tom Kenny and I answered it, and he thought we were adults.
But you were not.
We were high schoolers, and so we showed up, and he still put us on stage. I think he really did need... He always says, well, I knew you guys were funny. I think he needed bodies, you know.
Yeah. You had a pulse. You were
carbon-based. It wasn't now where everybody says they're a comedian, you know. But he kindly put us up, and that's how our friendship started.
I don't know how you found the nerve to go in there as teens and try to do stand-up. Stand-up is so hard.
Well, but stand-up comedy, people will say, boy, that takes a lot of nerve. And I just think your need to be accepted outweighs your shame. I don't know if it's courageous.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's just kind of desperate.
It's just another form of neurosis.
So you meet Barry Crimmins. He's like this super intense political guy, angry, but highly, highly political. What did you make of him?
I was a little frightened of Barry when I was – still am. But when I was a young man, I was – what it was I saw him doing his act, and he just said exactly how he felt. And I didn't think, wow, that takes a lot of courage. I just more like went, oh, that's how you do comedy, you know? You just, you know, be true to yourself. And so Barry influenced me in that way, I guess. But he's an imposing figure, still is, you know?
Did the political stuff just go by your head, or did you?
Some of it did. You know, he did do some traditional stand-up when we first started working with him, and his act became more and more political as he went on. I mean, my favorite Barry joke is people say, if you don't love this country, why don't you leave it? He says, because I don't want to be a victim of its foreign policies. So he was always this sharp guy. But he had regular stand-up at the beginning, and then he morphed more to all political satire. And this is in the 80s. It wasn't like now where there's Jon Stewart and all these other things like that. So, and I think part of that was his story. Like, once he started dealing with his rapes as a child and became an advocate, I feel like that affected his act, where he no longer had any interest in doing anything other than being a satirist on a political level.
So you're a young guy, you're performing in this club, mm-hmm. and then you obviously climb the ladder of stand-up to playing.
Well, this was in Syracuse. There's a town called Skinny Atlas where Barry's from. That's where Tommy and I met him. Barry went to Boston. When I graduated from high school, I followed Barry to Boston and became a comedian, and he certainly helped me a lot.
I should just mention he helped a lot of people, you know, a lot of comics become very well-known and who became very well-known.
Yeah, the club that he ran was where Kevin Meaney, Paula Poundstone, Stephen Wright, you know, Lenny Clark, Dennis Leary. There was a whole bunch of comedians that came out of there, including myself. And those were people that Barry, you know, he ran the club and he had a really high standard. He asked that you were original, that you weren't derivative. So I think that's why, you know, he's an imposing figure, but at the same time, he's a big softie. So he's a weird guy because the people that are in the movie, you know, not just those people, but like Margaret Cho and Marc Maron and Patton Oswalt and David Cross, these are folks that either were influenced by him or fans of his, or, you know, he's loved, even though he can be so prickly.
Well, so when you go off and start becoming more of a famous comic, do you lose touch with him?
Always knowing what each other was up to. You know, I remember in the 80s him calling me up at 3 a.m. just hammered, and he's like, Goldthwait, you suck. And I go, and I was really hurt. I go, what's wrong? He goes, nothing. I just wanted to call a movie star because I'm drunk and I wanted to tell him he sucks. So we didn't lose touch, but what motivated me to make the movie was all the way in the mid-90s when Barry disclosed on stage during a benefit for children about his childhood rapes that happened when he was 4. And that set him on a path. And when he was looking for other adult survivors on the internet, as the beginning of the internet, he found on AOL there was a lot of pedophiles exchanging child pornography. And when he complained to AOL, they didn't do anything. When he went to the police, in the movie, they said, we didn't have computers yet. So he gathered all this evidence and then ended up embarrassing AOL on the floor of the Senate during a judiciary hearing.
And you have all that footage is in your, your film.
But that's what motivated me to make the movie. That was back in 95. And it just, to me, felt like a Capra story. You know, this little guy taking on this big corporation on the floor of the Senate. You know, and it was Barry. So it was funny and he was a fish out of water. I asked him to write a script.
So, because you conceived this as a fiction project initially. I mean, not fiction, a narrative. A feature.
Yeah, with someone else playing him, because I didn't want him to relive these events. And I think I probably was just thinking of a bigger movie, too. You know, that wasn't going to happen for years. But, you know, Robin Williams was my best friend, and he knew Barry's story and knew my passion for it. So he suggested that I make it a documentary. And that was just last year in the February. And I said, well, I don't really have money. So he gave me some money to start the movie. And that was 2014. And we stopped filming it just last year around this time. So it was shot really quickly and edited really quickly. And then it made it to Sundance, which was crazy.
Was that in your mind when you...
No. And Robin would be like, this is going to Sundance. And I'd be like, I didn't think it was going to get into Sundance, no. I mean, this is the third movie I've had there, but I don't know why. I just didn't,
You're a pessimist about that, huh?
Well, I don't take it for granted, Every time I get a movie there or any festival, I'm really excited.
Robin, actually, unfortunately, as we know, committed suicide. I don't know where you were in the process, but you were underway, clearly.
Oh, we were. Yeah, it was actually the movie, because he was aware of the process of it, because he and I talked almost every day. If not, we text every day. I had turned off my phone to finish the last interview, turned it back on, and then I got the message, And I wrapped on the same very day that he had passed away. So, I mean, I often, I avoided all contact with press and things when he died because I want to be, mostly because of his family and friends and people that really did work with him and love him. But, he passed away and the coroner's report came out, and I'm not a doctor, but it said he had Lewy body dementia, which is a form of dementia, and I was fully witness to him not processing things normally. So I think people, because we all have darkness in us, want to say, oh, it was his depression or is his alcoholism or his post-traumatic stress syndrome, all these different things. But at the end of the day, my friend got sick, and this is just me, I believe that's why he passed away. That's why he died. It wasn't, not everybody with Lewy body dementia dies that way, but it's really a terrible, terrible disease. And that doesn't get spoken about.
No, I mean, I knew he wasn't well, but I didn't know the specifics of what was wrong. And you decided to go ahead. I mean, you didn't have any thought about.
Well,
I read somewhere that
happened was when he passed away. I spent time again with reaching out to as many of his loved ones as I could, and then I sat there and I thought, well, what would he want? And I knew he would have wanted me to finish the movie. I knew he thought of this movie in terms of, like I said, he thought it was going to Sundance, and he believed in this movie. And so I said, well, okay, I'm going to finish the movie. And so I spent all my time with the editor, Jeff Stryker, finishing the movie. It's funny, I'm just coming out of all of it now lately, kind of decompressing from it all.
Coming up after a short break, Goldthwait on the imprint left by Police Academy. Ah! 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 You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Bobcat Goldthwait, director of the new documentary, Call Me Lucky. The film follows the life of comedian Barry Crimmins, an imposing figure who performed at his own comedy club in the 1980s. Crimmins would lumber on stage, smoking and drinking a beer.
I got caught smuggling books into Kentucky. Got off on a technicality no one could prove they were books.
Crimmins spoke out not just on the comedy stage, but also at anti-war rallies, like this one in Boston in 1990.
Unlike the U.S. government, I've never supported Saddam Hussein, nor have I supported the Shah of Iran, Shamir, Sharon, Suharto, Chiang Kai-shek, Christiani, Dovasan, the Somozas, the Duvaliers, Marcos...
In the nascent days of the internet, Crimmins found another target for his anger. Purveyors of child pornography online. Goldthwait has known Crimmins for decades, and he also knew why Crimmins landed on this particular issue.
He disclosed in a public manner during a show about his rapes. I knew before that because he told me, but I wasn't taken back. When he told me, there was a sense of relief because I knew my friend had all this anger and all this pain for all these years, and suddenly a piece of the puzzle snapped into place. So, you know, he says that for him it was really good, my reaction, that I was like, great, you know, let's not, you know, and meaning and great, that meant that, you know, we're going to start getting some work done and get some healing going, you know.
Your reaction was good then, that you didn't freak out or...
Yeah. You know, that's the thing. It's like, you know, at the end of the movie, it says, if you're a victim of abuse, tell someone, tell everyone. And I kind of wish I could add an amendment, or if you're not, just listen. Because I remember when he told me this, I was like, what do I do? What do I say? And I was like, oh, nothing. You know, just let him talk, you know.
And that was the right decision. There's a part of the film where you're talking to Barry's sister, and it seems like she's not actually prepared for you to ask her about.
Right. There's two things in the movie that my daughter has a problem with: that interview with his sister, because it looks like I'm sandbagging her, and then when Barry goes into the basement where he was raped. And both those things, I didn't take the time to spell out what happened. You know, Barry said, "Look, Bob's making a documentary on me, and he wants to interview you," and then she was like, I didn't know there was going to be cameras and all this stuff. It's like, and Barry's like, well, it was a movie, you know. but I'm so happy that she's in the movie, and I admire her courage, and I also needed her. It was really important. Other people have, you know, Barry, people, they've discussed these things. You know, that was one of the few times she ever discussed it, and she discussed it on camera. And it was really needed because people discredit abuse survivors, so I needed somebody that was a witness that drove home, you know, the fact what happened. And then Barry going in the basement, you know, I didn't want to do reenactments. I just wanted to shoot the space, you know. And when I've said this in the past, Barry said, you didn't want to do reenactments. But I just wanted these...
Dark.
Oh, it was all very dark, you yeah. know, just because it had to. And it's too... Two men that love each other. I don't think we could have made the movie without Gallo's humor. It would have been, it was hard anyways, but you know, that's what got us through. So he said, look, I'm not, as it says, he says in the movie, I'm not going to make a shrine to demons. And he wanted to demystify. He says, I'm going in that basement. You can film it or not. And I chose to film it. That's why it looks different than the rest of the movie. I had to scramble to get the cameras. I said, will you give me 5 minutes at least? And, you know, and my daughter's like, Dad, you know, it looks like you forced that guy to do that. And it looks like you did. But, you know, I'll take a hit. You know, I personally am not a fan of documentaries that change the subject's life in a way. I don't like that.
I completely agree.
And then I ended up doing this a little bit, you know, because it definitely did, you know, I hate to use the buzzword, but it did give him closure. And but he's also very eloquent in that basement. So I think it may look manipulative to some folks, but I stand by it because I think what he says in that basement is very important. And it also is an example of saying he is, you know, as he says, you go, you go through a problem, not around it. And that's one thing, to go through it. But I also wanted to show that he's passed it and moved forward.
So with Barry, in terms of his reaction when you're finishing the film...
Well, that's the thing. You know, I didn't show Robin, World's Greatest Dad, the movie, and I didn't show Barry, Call Me Lucky, and then the movie premiered in the same theater at Sundance. And I sat next to both these guys. And so Barry's watching the movie, and he's, and I'm like, oh, no. But, and then I had to think, well, Barry's watching this movie, which is his whole life with friends, family, all talking about him, and not necessarily... You know, I was trying to show people Barry's anger and who he was before.
Balance the picture.
Yeah. So that was uncomfortable. You know, I leaned over in the middle of it and I said, don't worry, I make you Jesus at the end. You know?
And did he feel okay? I mean, obviously.
I think it was hard for him to take in. And, you know, here's a guy who's out living in the woods, and then we make this movie about him, and then this crowd gives him like multiple standing O's, and they say not only do we like you, we love you, and we want to learn more, and that's got to be overwhelming.
Yeah,
know? And it's in a weird way, I feel weird that I did it to him.
Well, it's got to be a mixed at least somewhat good, right?
No? Oh, sure. I mean, I hope. I mean, the good is the amount of people we have coming up and disclosing to us. And. And, you know, if the movie does anything, it would be nice if it's just another little piece in the puzzle that makes people more comfortable about discussing this topic and taking away the weirdness. You know, it lives in the shadows. It has so much power because of all the shame and guilt and things that aren't needed. And if this helps remove it and make it something that people openly discuss, then that's great.
But obviously he didn't get to participate in the cut or anything like
that. No, no. I don't think... If someone made a documentary about me, I wouldn't want to be involved in the cut. And there's things in it that, you know, if you're going to make a documentary about me, you better include Police Academy and all this stuff that I'm embarrassed of, because you need to tell the story.
You're embarrassed of Police Academy.
Well, I really would have worked harder if I'd known that I'd be talking about them daily for the next 30 years. Like, I run into people, and that's
the first thing.
Oh,
I know.
My God. I'll be at film festivals. I had a guy in Detroit, and he's like, I'm your biggest fan. I go, oh, hi. He goes, can I have a picture? I go, of course you can. And he's like, what do you do now? And I'm standing out front of a theater that's playing Call Me Lucky.
Well, just take me through how you transitioned and made the decision to stop doing that stand-up and being that persona.
Well, I do stand-up. You know, I do stand-up to help make ends meet so I can keep making my movies outside the system. So I've never really officially stopped. But I did stop. You know, I've jokingly said in the past that I retired from acting the same time they stopped hiring me, so it worked out. But that's not even true. You know, I realized that none of this was making me happy. Trying to write scripts that for other people or for me, trying to get cast and things and all this stuff. This is this wheel, you know? And I went and wrote a screenplay just because I questioned if I could even write a screenplay that I could hand to someone that they would, you know, get. And that was the movie. It was called Stay originally, and then it became Sleeping Dogs Lie. And I shot that movie for $20,000 with a crew from Craigslist, and I went to Sundance. and that changed my life because that voice that I stopped listening to early on in my career did work. I just was ignoring it because people were offering me money and fame and things that don't fulfill you, that don't fill the hole. I mean, maybe they do for some folks. I wasn't very happy when I was well-known. And then I just got on this path of, you know, I often say it's important to quit often until you end up someplace you don't want to leave. And that's where I am now.
Bobcat Goldthwait is the director of Call Me Lucky. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Thank you.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.